Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on what the hell's going on here when we come back. You know, a $10 pizza has a 38% tax on it. A Budweiser six-pack is taxed 43%. And a fifth of Jack Daniels is taxed at 72%. Now, governments tax us all, and they tax anything that wiggles, moves, or squirms. But what is it that government is doing or does to produce, to prepare, or to deliver, for which the government gets paid 38% for a pizza, 43% for a beer, or 72% for a drink? Does the pizza parlor make 38% profit on a pizza that they buy the ingredients to make, prepare it, cook it, serve it, and pay rent on the store where you sit and eat it? Well, why is it that government gets paid more in tax than the people who actually produce, prepare, and deliver the goods and services that we all buy? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, our school tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for your free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct, 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. Hey, we've been talking about what the hell's going on here. There are some stories here in the news that are so unbelievable that we have to just ask ourselves, oh my God, what does this mean? Where are we going from here? Now, I got a piece in across my desk here the other day, and I got to share this one with you. It says, have you got $2,200? Now just think about this for a minute. $2,200. Have you got $2,200? Because if you do, on planet Earth, you are considered to be rich compared to the other people that live on the planet with you. That's all it takes, $2,200, and you are rich. A global study reveals an overwhelming wealth gap on planet Earth, with the world's three richest people having more money than the poorest 48 nations combined. Now, boys and girls, let's think about that for a second, because there's only 200 countries in the world. 200 countries in the world. 192 of them are in the United Nations. And out of those 200 countries, about 50, that's 48, 25%, the poorest 25% of the countries on planet Earth, all of their wealth combined, doesn't equal the amount of money that Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and one Mexican town in Mexico City have between the three of them, or among the three of them. Think of that. Now, you may believe, and you've heard this statistic before, but maybe you haven't heard all of the story, because for the first time, personal wealth, now we're not talking about income here, not income, not how much money do you make every year, it's how much wealth do you actually have? Or do you actually own? It's been measured around the world by the United Nations. And the findings may be surprising, because what makes people wealthy across the world spectrum is relatively low. And the research indicates that assets of just $2,200 per adult would place a household in the top half of the world's wealthiest. Did you get that, children? If you've got $2,200, it puts you in the top half Now, there's about 6.6 billion people in the world. And you're in that wealthiest half, 3.3 billion people, if you've got $2,200. Half the people in the world don't have $2,200. So to be among the richest 10% of adults in the world, it just takes $61,000 in assets. So if you've got a house and you've got $61,000 net, $61,000 net equity in that house, if you compare yourself to the rest of the people of the world, you're in the top 10% of the wealth holders on planet Earth. If you have more than $500,000, $500,000, you're part of the richest 1%. The United Nations study says, indeed, 37 million people now belong in that category. So if you've got $500,000, now it takes most of us out of that range, but just think about this for a minute. There's a lot of people out there that have $500,000. A lot of you businessmen have businesses and you have homes and you have assets and inventories and so on that would total $500,000. That would put you in the top 1%. Top 1% of the Earth's population. Just $500,000. Now, half of the people in the world live on less than $2 a day. Sure, you can now be proud that you're rich, but take a moment and think about it. You're probably, you'll probably realize or come to realize that the meaning behind these numbers is harrowing. Because if it takes just a couple of $1,000s to qualify as rich on planet Earth, imagine what it means to be poor. Half the world, 3 billion people, live on less than $2 a day. The three richest people in the world, Microsoft Chairman Bill Gates, investor Warren Buffett, and Mexican telecom mogul Carlos Helu, H-E-L-U, have more money than the poorest 48 nations combined. The poorest 48 countries in the world have less money, less assets, total, than those three men in the United States. Well, one of them's in Mexico. Even relatively developed nations have now thresholds of per person capital. For example, people in India have per capita assets of $1,100. In Indonesia, capital amounts to $1,400 per person. The study's authors defined net worth as the value of people's physical and financial assets, less their debts. Oh, I'm going to underline that one. Less your debts. Because, you know, a lot of people, and I was talking to my wife last night, and I said, you know, I can remember years ago when I was in California in a contracting business, I used to go into the bank, you know, and want to borrow money so I could do another job, you know. And in back in the 60s and 70s, you know, $200,000, $300,000 was a lot of money. And I'd go in there with my balance sheet, you know, and show all my assets and then show all my liabilities. And my assets and liabilities would show a net. In other words, you might have assets of $300,000 and then you might have liabilities of $200,000, which means that you've got a net balance of $100,000 showing on your balance sheet. And so you say, wow, I'm worth $100,000. See, it makes you feel real good. So when you get through subtracting your assets and your liabilities, what is it that you really have? We'll get into that in a little bit. Because people come here to the law school and go to my business class from time to time. And then we ask the question, well, how much money do you have? Or where's your financial position? And almost every time they'll say, well, I've got a house, and my house is worth $300,000, and I owe $200 on it, so I've got a balance of $100,000 worth of equity. And people call that wealth. I mean, honest to God, you know, they believe that they're wealthy people because they've got this balance. And I'm going to show you here in a couple of minutes that, you know, we Americans are worse off than the average Indian or Indonesian. It actually has $1,400. I mean, some of these people actually have net assets without any liens on them. Because if you've got a house with a lien on it and you lose your job, Sam, you're going to lose the house and your equity. just because you've got an equity in the house doesn't mean you've got any wealth in the house. That's the bottom line. I know that people have automobiles. They go out and they buy a car for $30,000. They pay on it for a year or two or three, and the value of the car is $20,000, and they've paid the note down to $15,000. And they say, well, I've got an asset here of $5,000. Just miss two payments and see what kind of an asset you get. And then after they take the car away from you, take a look at the deficiency judgment that you've got left to pay. And then tell me how wealthy you are. The way we Americans count wealth and the way wealth is actually counted is something else again. Something else again, troops. Well, anyway, that said, it's interesting to look at how those at different economic levels manage their capital. You know, property, particularly land and farm assets, are more important in less developed countries because of the greater importance of agriculture and because financial institutions are immature. I want to underline that. Financial institutions are immature, and these people value land and cattle more than they do stocks and bonds. The study also reveals the differences in the types of financial assets owned. Savings accounts are strongly featured in transition economies and some rich Asian countries, while stock and other types of financial products are more commonplace in Western nations. Stocks and other types of financial products. So, we buy paper over here. See, an American, he has stocks and bonds, and maybe he's got mortgages and second deeds of trust and things like that. Maybe he even has some paper gold. And he says to himself, well, look at my wealth. Not understanding that all of that is vulnerable. None of it is physical. It's all on paper. And when that paper gets washed away, when it gets wiped out, like a Great Depression of the 1920s or 07 or 22 or 40 or 1836, you know, those paper assets just evaporate overnight. You saw that in 2000 when the stock market collapsed. $7 trillion worth of American wealth was just wiped out. I suppose some of you Germans and Frenchmen and Englishmen probably had some money in the stock market here in the United States at that time, but primarily it's Americans that invest in the American stock market, and primarily it's you Germans that invest in your German stock market. I know that different people in different countries invest in other people's stocks, but, you know, primarily it's the people of those countries. And those stock markets, when they go up and they go down, when economies collapse like Argentina did in 2000 or 2001, and one day they wake up and they got 62% unemployment, everybody's savings are gone, and then you find out, well, who's really got the money? And here's some poor Asian guy, you know, who's got maybe two cows and an acre or two, but he owns it free and clear. You know, who's the wealthier guy? Think about that for a second. Now listen, we got a real problem here in the U.S. budget. The real U.S. budget shortfall for the year 2006, which ended, by the way, on October the 1st. I don't know if you're aware of that, but we have what we call a fiscal year. And so we're in the fiscal 2007 year. Starts on October the 1st through September the 30th. And that'll be the 2007 fiscal year. Well, we just completed the fiscal year 2006, and the official budget deficit that came in was $248 billion. And that's bad. You know, we spent $248 billion more than we earned. You know, put it down here at the plumber's level. You know, you're making $100,000 a year, and you had a good year this year. As Babe Ruth said, I had a better year than the president, but you had a good year, and you spent $110,000 or $120,000. You made $100,000, but you spent $120,000. And we'd say, well, that's not good. That's not good. Because next year, if you make $80,000, you still have to pay that $20,000 shortfall, you know, at some point in time. So now you've got a little more debt. You got a little more mortgage that you got to pay off at some future time, you know, and that's fine. As long as you're making your payments every month, there's no problem. But the real shortfall last year, now this is one fiscal year, this is just 12 months. We're not talking about the whole national debt now, but just for last year, 2006, the actual shortfall was $4.6 trillion. Trillion, spelled with a T. I'm going to underline that. Get that number in your head. The actual budget deficit in the United States of America, the federal budget deficit, not talking about Texas, California, and Florida now, just the federal budget deficit for the year 2006 is $4.6 trillion. And you know something else? The entire war in Iraq has been financed off budget. Did you know that? Financed off budget. It's kind of like running the CIA, which runs an off-budget program. Well, listen to this. The real 2006 federal budget deficit was $4.6 trillion, not a previously reported $248.2 billion, according to the 2006 financial report of the United States government as released by the Treasury Department on Friday. Now, this is dated 12/24. Let me look up here on my calendar. Dated 12/24, so it was put out on Sunday. Now I'm looking at the report. The report came out on Sunday, 12/24, and it was a report from the previous Friday, which was December the 22nd. So the United States Treasury put out their annual report on Friday the 22nd. Now, it may be too soon. We'll have to wait and see. Maybe on the 26th, 27th, and 28th, and 29th, which will be Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, the week between Christmas and New Year's, maybe Katie Couric and Brian Williams and maybe Time and Newsweek and the rest of the big moguls of media will report to us what the real budget deficit was. President Bush isn't telling us that it's $4.6 trillion. He's telling us it's $248 billion. Remember that? Now, what the hell's going on here that the budget deficit reported by the Treasury is $4.6 trillion and the President's telling us it's $248? And then the news media, CBS, ABC, and NBC, the news media, don't tell us a word about it. They report the $248. What's going on there? Can you figure that one out? Now, the 2006 federal budget deficit of $4.6 trillion is $1.1 trillion more than the 2005 federal budget deficit. Oh, my God. Let me underline that. It's $1.1 trillion. Now, let's put 4.6 into our famous Texas Instruments. GEL 1197 G3, and then we'll put 4.6 in there, and then let's take 1.1 and I'll hit the red button. Last year, in the year 2005, the budget deficit was $3.5 trillion. Can you add that up, boys and girls? That's 4 and 3 is 7. That's 7.6 trillion, isn't it? I just boggles my mind. You know, a trillion is 1,000 billion. I can remember when John F. Kennedy proposed in 1961. That was the first year that he was in office. He proposed a budget, a federal budget of $100 billion. That's a tenth of a trillion. Today, our federal budgets are running around $2.5 trillion a year, and the deficits that they're running is $4 trillion this year, $3.5 trillion last year. Now, did anybody report that to you? Did you ever hear that? Well, the Treasury reports that. The numbers are available. And of course, most of us, we rely upon Time or Newsweek or U.S. News or USA Today or the local newspaper, or we rely upon Katie Couric or, you know, Dan Rather or Brian Williams or somebody to tell us, you know, what's going on. But we're not being told. Now, you suppose maybe there's a reason for that. Maybe this is more than you average plumbers, carpenters, and electricians and truck drivers can handle. Not that it really means anything to you anyway, but I just thought I would share it with you and point out to you that the budget deficits are so far out of balance that the economy, that is the whole United States monetary system, is on the verge of collapse. The verge of collapse. And this isn't just last year and this year. It's been going on now for the last 30 years, but I just thought I would share with you how dire the circumstances have become. Now listen, to show you how bad the money situation is, the Republicans who were just voted out of office enacted what they call a continuing spending bill. That is, it's a temporary budget spending operation to keep the government running without actually budgeting the money for the year 2007. And it was reported, I saw the numbers here the other day, that the Democrats aren't in a mood and probably will not in the fiscal year 2007 enact any budget. They're just going to continue spending on this continuing spending temporary bill. Nothing cast in cement. They're just, in other words, they're just going to write checks and sign them on the bottom line, but they're not going to budget anything. Now, what in the hell is going on here? Now, here's another little number for you to get in mind here. Get your pencil out here and jot this down. I just saw this number. Kind of boggled my mind. There was a survey recently, and the top CEOs in the country, the people like Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and they listed about 10 in the list. I didn't recognize the other names, but I recognized those two, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. And there's 8 more in this list of 10. Top CEOs, you know, the CEOs of General Motors and Ford and Walmart and Microsoft and Berkshire Hathaway, and they listed all these big companies out here. Get this. Here's your CEOs. Here's your Bill Gates. For every share of stock that they're buying, they're selling 67. The top 10 CEOs, chairman of the boards, you know, the chief executive officers, the guys that are running Enron, the guys that are running WorldCom, the guys that have PhDs and MDAs and all this crap behind their names, these people that went to Harvard and Yale and run the biggest businesses, the biggest multinational corporations like Walmart and so on, these guys are selling 67 shares of stock for every share of stock that they're buying. Now, what in the hell does that tell you? The top business leaders in the country don't have as much confidence in the stock market as you do. That's what that tells me. Now, fortunately for me, I don't have any stocks, and I'm just reporting to you. It might be fortunate for you if you followed the top 10 CEOs of America who are in the process of unloading their stock. As of this date, 12/26/06. But it gets better. Let me find my spot here. The 2006 budget deficit of $4.6 trillion is $1.1 trillion more than the 2005 federal budget. The federal budget deficit. Econometrician, I guess is the way you pronounce that. God, that's a new word. Let me get that one down. Econometrician John Williams, I guess that's an economist, who publishes the website Shadow Government Statistics, told WND the Bush administration is in an untenable situation with a budget deficit this dramatic, taxing 100% of all wages, salaries, and corporate profits would not eliminate a deficit of this magnitude. And cutting Social Security and Medicare spending is politically impossible. In his subscription newsletter, Williams comments that the GAAP accounting numbers reported in the 2006 Treasury report show that the actual deficit number was nearly 19 times the size of the gimmicked official deficit for 2006 of $248 billion. So they're telling us that the budget deficit's $250 billion in round numbers, and the real deficit's $4.5 trillion. 19 times greater than is being reported. So I got to ask, what the hell's going on? What's that all about? Now, if you think that this is just some nitwit over here, this guy is reporting, this is World Net Daily, is reporting on the Treasury report that they put out on Friday, the 22nd of December. I mean, we're not talking about numbers that came out of some boilerplate economist's boardroom, you know, in New York, who's a right-wing radical Democrat, you know, or a communist. We're talking about the numbers that the Bush administration's putting out. It's their Treasury. It's their man Paulson from Goldman Sachs. So, you know, I'm just a crummy plumber down here at the bottom of the pecking order, but I can look at this and say, oh my God, this doesn't sound good at all. If I had stock in a company like this, I'd want to get rid of it. I mean, if I had a business like this, I'd be looking for a buyer. This is insane. This is beyond insane. I say it's beyond insane. I can't even describe it. I've got enough vocabulary here. I'd have to rely on four-letter words to describe this. Now, in his subscription newsletter, Williams comments that the GAAP accounting numbers reported in the 2006 Treasury report show that the actual deficit numbers are 19 times the size of the gimmicked official deficit for 2006 of $248 billion. Total obligations were 4.2 times annual U.S. gross domestic product. Total obligations. Now, you take this $4.2 trillion, and then you add last year's $3.5 trillion, and then you take a look at the war in Iraq, and the money that's been borrowed off budget, and the baby boomers that are coming on stream in 2008 for their Social Security slop trough welfare benefits and so on, programmed out into the next 20 or 30 years. You take a look at the total number that we owe, that we have obligations to pay. Kind of, you know, add up your mortgage. It's true, your mortgage isn't due and payable today. It's payable over the next 20 or 30 years. But it's a total debt. You know, if you've got a mortgage of $250,000 on your house, and your payments are $2,000 a month, it is true that you don't owe the $250,000 next month, but you still owe the $250,000 plus interest for the next 20 years, which means at 6% or 7% interest over the next 20 years that it's actually double that. So if you owe $250,000 and your interest rate is 6% and you're going to pay this over the next 30 years, then you're going to pay about 125% more than that. So it's $250,000, $500,000, it's about $625,000. Over the next 30 years. Now divide that number by 360 months, and that tells you what your real debt is. And that's what they're not doing here in the federal budget process. What they do is they add up the total monthly payments. How much do you actually owe today? And let's sit down and write our checks. So you got income of $5,000 and you've got outgo of $4,992 and you say, wow, that's great, because we could meet all of our payments this month. Now what they're not telling you is that this is growing exponentially. That means it's growing 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. And it's doubling every so often, and that's what makes this whole thing so untenable, because by the time these baby boomers come on stream, and you've got this Medicare obligation, and you've got this Social Security obligation that you're going to be paying out over the next 20 or 30 years, it now totals $67 trillion. Boys and girls, that's more money than we got. That's the problem that you face when you take a look at your projections for the future, and it says, well, we're making $5,000 a month, and we're paying out $4,900. But next year at this time, we're going to be paying out $5,300 a month. Are we going to be making $5,400 a month next year, or are we still going to be making the same $5,000? And then the next year, it's going to be $6,400. And then the next year, it's going to be $7,700. And then it grows by geometric progression. It's not $500 a year. It's $500 this year, $1,000 next year, $2,000 the year after that, and $4,000 the year after that, and so on up the line. And you have to have income, or you have to be able to produce enough wealth to make those payments. And the bottom line is, the projections are we're not going to be making that kind of money. Now, what's that mean? Well, isn't that insolvency? Well, what happens when countries go insolvent? Well, let's go back about 3 or 4 years and take a look at Argentina. When it went insolvent, what happens is that the people that you're buying from, you know, you're in Argentina and you're buying shoes from China. Just like we Americans are sitting over here buying shoes from China. And 99% of our shoes come from outside of our borders because our shoe industry has been decimated here. It's been destroyed. It's been sent overseas. And all of a sudden, you can't meet your payments because, you know, your payments this month are $5,400, but your income's only $5,000, so you're short. And so when you end up short and you're unable to meet your payments, you become insolvent. Then your creditors in mass, all of them, they take a look at you and say, hey, listen, you cannot service all of your debt. You can service most of it, but you can't service all of it. Therefore, you're in breach of contract. Therefore, our agreement, our deal is dead. And now we're going to put the acceleration clause in. Now you owe us the full amount. Pay us. And you can't pay off. I mean, boys and girls, if you can't pay $5,000 a month, you sure as hell can't pay $250,000, can you? And so all of a sudden, now they want to foreclose. So they come in and say, okay, well, you owe us this, and you owe us that, and you owe us something else, and we're going to take that. We're going to clean out your bank accounts over here. The money that we've got in your banks, we're taking it out. And then we're going to put you on COD, which means that when you want to buy, you got to pay us cash. That means that when you walk into the store to buy your groceries, the grocer says, well, since you didn't make your payments, well, we're not going to extend you any more credit. So now you got to actually pay at the cash register for everything you take. Now all of a sudden you're on COD, so now you stop making any of your payments. Well, it's a logical thing to do. So now you're not making any payments. All of your creditors now are foreclosing or taking the car, they're taking the furniture, they're taking the big screen TV, they put you on COD, and now you got to pay for everything that you buy. Now here's our problem in America. We buy $800 billion a year, just a little less than a trillion a year, from other countries. We sell about $200 billion a year to other countries. So get this, we're buying eight and we're selling two, that's a deficit of six. So all of a sudden, you're going to have a standard of living change. Can you see the standard of living change? You were living on 800, and now you're going to be living on 200. COD, cash. All of a sudden, $600 billion is taken away from you. So if you're making $800 a month, I mean, if you're spending $800 a month and you're making two, and you go on COD, all of a sudden, instead of your $800 a month standard of living, it's going to drop to two. Going to drop down to about a fourth of what you're used to. So just get ready, boys and girls, because it's about to hammer us. Hang on. I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log, our schedule, and the archives, and that can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one for yourself. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org or call us direct at 417-273-4967. One more reminder here, and that is that we're offering a new class on health and healing, which covers the alternative methods. That's alternative healing methods, the opposite to allopathic medicine. And that is now being used for treatment and healing of cancer, a disease now affecting about 1 out of every 2 Americans. In other words, in your lifetime, you're going to come down with cancer. 50% of us are going to come down with cancer. And they tell us by the year 2020, which is only, 15 years away, that it should be 1 out of 1. Everybody should have cancer one time in their lifetime by 2020. And how to prevent this degenerative disease and degenerative diseases in general, along with abdominal fat and the use of and the application of essential oils, super nutritional foods containing more nutrients and fewer calories. Now, the class also includes hand-on teaching, paperwork, allergic reaction testing and training so we can do it at home, acupressure application and training so you can find the pressure points, and much, much more to contribute to your ongoing health. Now, the class will be coming in February. It's February 5th through the 9th. Here in Isabella, Missouri. If you're interested, then call my wife, Jackie. The number's 417-273-4967. Remember, my wife now is a 28-year cancer survivor. This is a program to teach you how to rather than what to. It's easy to tell you, well, here's what you ought to do. Here's what you ought to do. Take vitamins. And then nobody tells you, well, which vitamins do you take and when do you take them, and They use a lot of five-syllable, double-jointed, knee-action words, like lysine and amino acids and enzymes and nutrients and vitamins and fatty acids and so on. When you get down to the bottom line, is that really what you need to know? It may be good for PhDs who are trying to impress one another with their vocabulary, but what does it do for a truck driver or a Sally housewife that's got cancer or multiple sclerosis or muscular dystrophy or Parkinson's disease or something like that? What do you do to treat that? What do you do to cure it? That's the main thing. What do you do to get rid of it? We'll try to answer those questions for you here at the class. Remember, that's February 5th through the 9th. All right, now with that reminder out of the way, let's get back over here. I said I was going to tell you about this thing of the American that comes into class here at business school. And he brings in his balance sheet, and he sees himself as being pretty wealthy. He drives a new car, lives in a pretty nice house, he's making $100,000 a year. Now, if you're making $100,000 a year, boys and girls, you're in the top 5% of income earners here in America. $100,000 a year, that's pretty good money. And to make 120 or 30 or 50 or 1,000 a year, whatever you're making, you got to be a doctor or a real estate broker or, you know, dentist or somebody like that, typically a professional guy. Nor a small businessman could do that, you know. You might have three or four trucks operating or something, you know. And these guys come in and they'll say, well, here, I'm making $100,000 a year. And you say, well, do you have any credit cards? Yeah. Well, what's your credit card debt? And then they start adding up their credit card debt. Got a house? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, what's the debt on your house? Well, I owe $200,000 on my house or something like that. How about your inventory? Well, you know, I've got inventory over here that I'm paying on, or flooring or something like that. So, you know, you start adding up this guy's liabilities, and oftentimes the assets and the liabilities, and typically a guy will have some assets. He'll have a balance over here. So, you know, he has $1 million worth of assets, and he's got $500,000 worth of liabilities. And he says, well, then I'm worth $500,000. Now, let's take a look at what we've learned already today. You've got a budget deficit over here running in the trillions of dollars a year. You've got a Congress that hasn't even got a budget. They're operating on a continuing spending operation. You've got a war that you don't even add up the numbers for. You just write the checks and spend them. You've got the top 10 CEOs in America selling 67 shares of stock for every share of stock they're buying. Now, what's that tell you? I mean, it ought to tell you that the whole damn economy is on the verge of collapse. I mean, you know, we're a bunch of fools over here that are denying reality. Or maybe it's because nobody's ever told you where in the hell this thing is going or what's going on. Maybe that's the problem. But in any event, the average American today, he's got $500,000 or $100,000 or $200,000, $300,000 on his balance sheet, and he says, well, my God, I'm a pretty wealthy guy. You know, I'm doing all right. You're doing all right as long as the economy's cooking. And as soon as it turns south like it did in Argentina 4 or 5 years ago, you're going to lose your job. You're running four trucks. What in the hell are you going to do when there's nothing to haul on your four trucks? You know, a lot of you little trucking guys out here, you know, you got four or five trucks operating and things are going pretty good. You know, you're getting paid $1 a mile or something like that, or $2 a mile or whatever. And you know, and you're making a little money coming in over here. Now, last month, the total tonnage here in the United States went down by 2%. Now, when transportation goes down, it is the precursor to a recession. And we've already entered the recession. The G, that is the gross domestic product, is contracting. Now, when that happens and you don't have enough money to pay the payments on those four or five trucks, partner, what are you going to do next? See where we're going here with this? Okay. Now, the little guy that's got a couple of acres and a rice paddy over in Borneo, you know, he owns his 2 acres and he owns a couple of head of livestock over here, and he owns that free and clear. He's better off than you are with your five trucks mortgaged. And that's because nobody's going to take his rice paddy and his 2 water buffalo, but somebody's going to take them 5 trucks away from you. Now you got no way to make a living. And now you're unemployed. Now you're out of business. Probably have a deficiency judgment against you. And then you've got all the rest of your bills. I mean, you're still making payments on your big screen TV and on your house and on your cars and pickups and all the rest of it. Now what are you going to do? And then the next step is, well, they come and take your pickups, and pretty soon they foreclose on your house, and pretty soon you're out on the street. Now that's what the bottom line is. That's what our problem is. That's where we're headed. Americans are worse off than some guy that's maybe only got $2,000 or $3,000 and sitting over in a rice paddy someplace in the Far East than we are here in America, because typically when people come in here, they've got debt. They got debt. Just add up your debts and then ask the question, well, what are they going to take away from you? Well, on your credit card's not going to take anything because it's unsecured. But your house is secured. Your car is secured. And you take a look at your secured debts, your furniture and so on, they're going to come take your furniture, your car, and your house. Now what else you get? Oh, you got inventory, you got a business, you know, all of that. It's all going to get swept away. Now, unless, of course, you can meet your payments. And of course, you know, everybody says, well, of course I can meet my payments. I've been making my payments in the past. Boys and girls, we've never been borrowing $4 trillion a year at the federal government level. We've never seen anything like this before. This is new territory here. And in the past, governments that have done that, like the Weimar Republic in Germany in 1923, they collapse. And then they go into dictatorship, like an Adolf Hitler. And that's what will probably happen here. George Bush, who's arguably the worst president we've ever had, will probably assume the role of Nero or Hitler or a dictator or a Saddam Hussein. When this thing collapses, we'll have to have a strong hand from somewhere, and who could be better than George? I mean, start picturing this now for a minute. Now, the calculations here going on, it says the calculations in the 2006 financial report of the United States government are calculated on a GAAP basis. It's called the Generally Accepted Accounting Practices, and that includes year-for-year changes in the net present value of unfunded liabilities in social insurance programs such as Social Security and Medicare. Under cash accounting, the government makes no provision for future Social Security and Medicare benefits in the year in which those benefits accrue. So, let me pause right here and let me explain that one to you, in case you're wondering. You see, you have liabilities coming on. So let's suppose that you're running your little trucking company over here, and you go out and buy another truck. And you add up the $500 a month payments that you're making on the truck, but you don't add onto your balance sheet the $80,000 that you just paid to Mack Truck Company over here for buying the truck. Well, partner, your balance sheet, you know, just took an $80,000 hit. That's what happened over here, and you're putting down $500 a month, $6,000. So you say, well, I got to pay $6,000 this year on that truck, but I'm not talking about the interest, and I'm not talking about the payments over the next 4 or 5 years on that truck. And that's the way your government's operating, at least at the federal level. I can't speak for your state, but I can speak for the feds now. And so you got more and more people going into the Social Security program every day. You know, somebody goes down, signs up for Social Security. That's a liability to the government. And these liabilities, these promises that are being passed out, the government is not going to pay you all of your Social Security money, kids. They're not going to pay you all of your Medicare money because they're not going to have it. Now, they're going to give you the actual dollars. And the way they do that is they just print them up and hand them out. Well, when you print them up and hand them out, well, then that causes what we call inflation, price increases. Now, let me show you where that's taken us. In 1930, the price of gold was $20.67 an ounce. $20 an ounce. So when you had a $20 double eagle, you had 1 ounce of gold or thereabouts. And that 1 ounce of gold was worth $20. Well, you were working for $1 or $2 a day. Today, you're making $100 a day. Now, take a look at the purchasing power. That $20 would have bought you a Hickey Freeman suit, wingtip shoes, would have bought you a shirt and suspenders and all the frills that go with your new wardrobe. $20. Today, gold is at about $600 an ounce, and it'll do the same thing. You can buy a Hickey Freeman suit and a pair of wingtip shoes and a shirt and suspenders and necktie for the same $600. So the gold hasn't increased in its price at all. Still worth about the same as it was then, purchasing power-wise. Now take a look at your $20 bill. In 1930, a $20 bill, a Federal Reserve note, would have bought you a Hickey Freeman suit, wingtip shoes, shirt, suspender, everything that you need to deck yourself out. And today, take the same $20 bill down and you'd be lucky to buy the necktie. Now let me back up here for a minute. Let me show you where your money's going. If you take a look at prices, the price increases from the time George Bush took office, 2001 to 2006. We've got 6 years now. Under our belt, 6 years. In 6 years, prices have increased 30%. The purchasing power of your money has gone down by 30%. You have to have 30% more income today than you needed in 2000, 6 years ago, to buy the same amount of goods and services? Are you making 30% more than you were 6 years ago? Go back to 1980. In 1980, compared to 2006, it takes 50% more money. 50%. Your money has lost half of its purchasing power in 25 years, from 1980 to 2006. Let's go back a little bit further. 1971, the year that we went off gold and stopped paying our debts and picked up this fiat currency. Remember that? 1971. Okay, well today, you've lost 90% of your purchasing power, so you got to be making 90% more than you were making in 1971. Now let's carry this back to 1930. The purchasing power of money today compared to 1930 is 2 cents. It now takes a dollar to buy what 2 pennies bought in 1930. Now that's what's happened to your money. That isn't what happened to gold. Gold is undervalued by historical standards, but even at that, gold is still holding its value and becoming more valuable. Your paper money is becoming cheaper and cheaper. In fact, I gave you this story yesterday concerning the clad coins. I mean, in 1965, they went to this clad coinage. They took the silver out of your money, and they put these copper and nickel and all this crap into your sandwich money, we used to call it. And today, the sandwich money now costs more to make. You can melt the sandwich money down now, for crying out loud, and get more out of it than it costs to make it. Can you believe that? The cheap trash money. And then the Treasury says, well, we got to ban you people from melting down your pennies and nickels and dimes and so on and converting that in. You know, you can melt a penny down now and it's worth 2 cents. You can melt a nickel down now and it's worth 8 cents. That's the metal content of it. So they want to cheapen that. They're going to put cheaper metals out for 2007. Can you believe this crap? Boys and girls, money is a store of value. We want money to be worth something. Your government wants your money to be worth less and less, and they're devaluing it. And by the way, while we're talking about money, the dollar now is down pushing 80 on the index. It was up to 120. It's lost a third of its purchasing power in international markets, and it's expected to go down to about 40. So the dollar is going to lose half of its purchasing power over a relatively short period of time. I would say probably 1 year near 2007. It's going to lose half of its purchasing power. So from the 2 pennies that it's worth today, it's going to be worth 1 penny by the end of the year. Well, put another way, if you got $1,000 in the bank, you'll have about $500 left at the end of the year. So let's hear it for savings. Let's all run down to the bank and let's save a lot of money this year, huh? Let's put it in our mattress. Let's put these $100 bills in our mattress and save them. And boys and girls, you know we're on the verge now of total insanity here. I say it's time to wake up to reality, smell the coffee, you know, let's get on to something more intelligent. Now, Williams points out there's no Social Security lockbox. There are no funds held in reserve today for Social Security and Medicare obligations that are earned every year. It's only a matter of time until the public realizes that the government is truly bankrupt and no taxes are being held in reserve to pay in the future the Social Security and Medicare benefits that taxpayers are earning today. Now, calculations from the 2006 financial report of the United States government also show that the GAAP negative net worth of the federal government has increased to $53.1 trillion, while the total federal obligations under GAAP accounting now total $54.6 trillion. The Treasury is right in that Social Security and Medicare must be shown as liabilities on the federal balance sheet in the year they accrue. To do otherwise is irresponsible, nothing more than an attempt to hide the painful truth from the American public. And the public has a right to know just how bad off the federal government and the federal budget deficit situation really is, especially since the situation is rapidly spinning out of control. Let me underline that. Rapidly spinning out of control. Now, if you're on Social Security, I mean, you know, when prices double and you're getting half as much, I mean, they'll give you more dollars. I mean, if you're getting $1,000 a month from Social Security, they're going to give you $2,000 a month, and then $4,000 a month, then $8,000 a month, then $16,000 a month, while the price of bread goes from $1 a loaf to $2 to $4 to $8 to $16 to $32 to $64 a loaf. And you'll always be behind the power curve, so your standard of living is always going to be declining. Now, how do you like that for a prospect? And that's the way inflationary cycles go, and that's where we're headed. We're headed into hyperinflation. That's what the bottom line is. Now, we've been having inflation over the last 6 years at the rate of about 10% a year. Now, the full impact of that inflationary binge that we've been on over the past 6 years hasn't materialized yet, because there's a lag time between the time that the government prints or puts this money or lends this money into circulation and the time that the businesses actually raise their prices and prices go up. It's a lag time. It takes about a year and a half to 2 years. So we've seen the inflationary impact of the 30% decline in our purchasing power over the last 6 years. That's 30%. You're going to face another 30%, but it's not going to take 6 years because it's already in the pipeline, probably over the next year or 2 years. Now, that's where we're headed. So you need to start making some plans to compensate for that. And a debt reduction is certainly a step in the right direction. A food supply on hand, a piece of property that's free and clear that nobody else knows about. You know, some emergency planning needs to be put into operation. The federal government is bankrupt, Williams explained. And in a post-Enron world, if the federal government were a corporation such as General Motors, the president and the senior treasury officers would be in the federal penitentiary. If we applied the same standards that we applied to the Enron and the Bernie Elders or Ebers or Bernie Ebers, I believe it was, who is now in the federal pen, then the Secretary of the Treasury and the President ought to be in the pen also, because they're not only spending us into bankruptcy, they're hiding it. And isn't that what Ken Lay was doing over at Enron? Wasn't he hiding the true state of the financial condition of the Enron Corporation? Isn't that why he was convicted? Well, what in the hell is the difference between the Secretary of the Treasury, the Chief Financial Officer, and the Chairman of the Board of the United States of America, George Bush, doing the same thing? And with that, boys and girls, we'll have to conclude today's program by reminding you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, 8 schools in all. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.